Ignored Podcast is brought to you by Lucy Pet Food. Why feed Lucy Pet Food? Because they specialize in gut health, which is vital to the overall health of your dog. I feed it to all my dogs because it works. Go check them out today at lucypetfood.com. One of the most annoying things dogs can do is bark excessively. Trust me, I know, I train them all day long. And unfortunately, barking is one of the number one causes of animal control being called. And if animal control is called one too many times, now the court systems take over and they deal with you. And trust me, you do not want that to happen. Now, as you all know, I'm a technique junkie. I typically prefer to train my dogs off of technique rather than use a tool. But what happens when I meet that one dog that I just can't get through to them with a technique to stop their barking on command? It's rare, but it happens. This is where I pull out a handy little tool known as the Bark Be Gone. It's a cool little handheld device that with a simple push of a button, it instantly stops your dog from barking. Okay, so how does it work? Don't worry, it's not a shock collar. I wouldn't do that to you guys. It's ultrasonic technology. It simply emits a high-pitched ultrasonic sound which immediately distracts your dog from barking. So stop yelling and screaming at your dog for barking all day long with no results and go to barkbegone.com. And who wants a discount? For 20% off, use the promo code Brandon at checkout. Go to barkbegone.com. That's BARKBEGONE.com. Go check them out right now and stop your dog's annoying barking habit for good. Please welcome to the show, Paul DeGelder. Well, but let's get right to it. Okay, so what year was this? Tell me about, we're going to get to this really quickly because I know you don't want to talk about too much shark attacks here. But tell me about the attack. When was it? Exactly where were you? And what was that day like?
So it was 2009. I had joined the Australian Army Paratroopers in November 2000 to escape a life that I didn't really feel was going anywhere. I gave it a shot.
Wait, hold on. Back up. What was going on with your life?
I flunked high school because...
Hey!
Yeah.
Put it there, pal.
Nice, yeah. We're both doing all right.
I'm just kidding, kids. Don't drop out of high school.
No, definitely don't drop out of high school.
Just, I dropped out too. Yeah.
Get guidance before you finish high school about what you can do with the things that you're learning about. You know, I couldn't piece it together. There was no guidance in high school. It's just like, you will learn maths, English, science, whatever. But they didn't tell you the careers out there in the world that these classes would help you to achieve. You know, it was like, what am I going to do? I'm going to be a doctor, maybe a lawyer, be a police officer like my dad. It was just so limiting. I didn't know what to do. And I just didn't, and I'm still this way. If I don't see the point in doing something, I won't do it. And so I'm a little wiser now. I do search out the points for why I do things. But even on a shoot, if the production company are telling me to do something or they want to do something and I don't see the point of it, I'm going to push back at them because I want to know intrinsically, why am I doing this? Why am I putting this effort? How is it going to benefit me or the outcome of whatever we're doing? And so they don't do that in school. Back when I was there, they didn't. Yeah. They just expect you to be there and shut up and learn.
Yeah.
And I just don't operate that way. You know, I'm a visual learner, and that's why I did so well in the military. But so I was rebelling. I don't want to get too much into it because there was some bad stuff going on. I was self-harming for a while. I was slashing my own arms up at the frustration of having no control over my life. All boys Catholic school. Dad was a cop. Mum was a disciplinarian. It was just all encompassing.
Wait, hold on. Is that what really happened? You're just lying.
Yeah. I just cut so many times. I got all the way through.
I want to make sure we're getting the truth here. We're friends, guys. I can bust.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Do you want to hold my arm while I? And so I rebelled and I got kicked out of home. Flunked high school. Luckily, had two friends take me in. Ended up working as a kitchen hand. There was a lot of partying going on because I was working at a club for a couple of years, and then I got jumped by 20 guys at a party, and I had to leave. It was, you know, it was. I looked in the mirror,
What did you do to get jumped by 20 guys?
It was a farewell for a friend of mine who was being deported out of the country for criminal activity. He was being sent back to Papua New Guinea. And so the people at this party were unsavory as it was. Yeah. And this little Indian kid, I was 18 at this point, so I could drink. And this little Indian kid was trying to convince me to buy him a beer. And I was like, what? Why am I going to buy you? I don't even know you. And like, he ended up throwing a glass of beer at me. He should have just drunk it. In hindsight, that would have been smarter. And so that was it. And I got up and I went towards him to have a go at him. And then all of his friends popped up and tried to punch me in. I'd been doing Muay Thai kickboxing at that point, so I dropped a fair few of them.
I was going to say, how'd that work out against 20?
Yeah. Well, at that point, it was kind of like 1, 2, 3 sort of popped up around him. And, you know, someone tried to hit me. I grabbed him by the shoulder and pulled him into my elbow. And then everyone jumped up and I backed out onto the balcony.
That sounds like a fair fight. I mean, if I knew a guy who was a high level Muay Thai kickboxer, I'd have to call 20 of my friends too.
I was definitely like, not
fair, buddy.
I lost more fights than I was in. Yeah, I wasn't competitive. I used to go out underage drinking with my friends and fight in the street, and more often than not, I would lose. But you know, that was my outlet. That took the focus away from self harming.
So is that why you joined the military? Because
that's why I left home. That's why I left Canberra, the city that I was living in Australia, which is the capital of Australia. Very pretty, very clean, very boring. It's where the politicians sit. There's nothing to do there. Marijuana is decriminalized there. Been decriminalized there for a very long time, and so there's a lot of weed. And so I got involved in that as well. But after the fight, it was just, I'm going to be dead or in jail by the time I hit 23,
yeah,
unless I remove myself from this environment that I've become a product of. You know, I was working behind a bar for a rebel motorcycle gang at the same time, and it was just all bad. And so I had this little car that I bought for $1,200 and I had no license. So I threw everything I had into it and I drove 12 hours north to Brisbane to start a new life. And my friend Matt got a job for me behind a bar in a strip club, and I became a rapper. And as you do, as a white Australian at 21.
A rapper?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
So put out an album, opened
Why
up for
Snoop. Why have I not heard your rap album?
Dude, I opened up for Snoop Dogg in 98.
You have an opportunity to open up for all of us right now.
Yeah, that was 20-something years ago. And, you know, it was cool. It was like I was working in the strip club, so all my friends were hot chicks. I was making music. We were running nightclubs. It was free drinks everywhere because everyone knew me from the strip club. And so, you know, I thought this was it. This was my calling. I was going to be a rapper, and just not a lot of money in white rapping.
White Australian rappers.
Yeah, 1998.
So you're saying Iggy Azalea, whatever her last name is.
Well, she was an anomaly like 5 years ago. You know, this was 1998.
I mean, you were ahead of the curve on her, but
yeah.
All right.
Yeah. I was the only, we had like a 13, 14 person crew. I was the only white Australian in the whole crew. We had like Filipinos, Malaysians, Sri Lankans, Latino American, a white American, Chilean. Like it was very Australian. It was very multicultural.
So it looked like a United Colors of Benedict advertisement.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Got
100%.
It.
Yeah. Cross colors jeans, that we used to shoplift. And, so as bands do, when the financial constraints get brought in and everyone's smoking a lot of weed and there was a lot of stress, and the band broke up, and me and some of my friends just decided we couldn't take it anymore. It was becoming physically violent at some points and emotionally abusive from the main guy who was running it all. And I just couldn't do it anymore. I left, and my friend left, and we got a place together and just started working behind a bar again. And I was a year into that, just wondering, is this going to be my life? And my two younger brothers had joined the army, and I called my mom and I said, you know, what do you think? What should I do? And she's like, why don't you talk to your two younger brothers? And so I called them up and I said, hey, what do you think about me joining the army? And they wet their pants. They laughed so hard, both of them, at separate phone calls. And they said, look, but it is a great life. They were both in artillery. They got to shoot the big rockets. They said, you get paid to play sport, paid to travel, you know, all that good stuff. Just one thing, though, don't join infantry. You know, you won't make it. It's just too hard. Just choose something easier. Mm-hmm. So I chose infantry. And became an airborne paratrooper. And they were right. It was hard, especially, you know, coming from rebelling against discipline my whole life to volunteering to be surrounded by the most disciplined, crazy people on the planet.
Yeah.
And it was really a hard adjustment. But I didn't have a choice. You know, I didn't have a home to go back to. I'd flunked high school. I didn't have any career prospects. I didn't have any money. Everything I owned was in one suitcase locked away somewhere else on the base. And so I didn't have a choice. And so I tried something new. I tried to change the way that I perceived the situation and change myself instead of running away again and changing the circumstances. And through that, you know, I focused on the things that I did enjoy. There was not a lot of cigarette smoking in basic training. And, you know, I'd been a pack-a-day smoker before that. And so my health and fitness started to come back because I was a state-level swimmer when I was a kid. My dad was the swimming coach, and so I couldn't really get out of it. And so that all the fitness from swimming started to come back, and I started to excel. And that, and I ended up boot camp with the physical training award, and that carried me over into infantry school, where I did really well there as well, and ended up becoming paratrooper and did some really amazing things. And I'll be forever grateful to the Army for teaching me how to be a real man, how to be a valuable member of society, and allowing me to serve my country. You know, I got to do sniper training, unarmed combat, jungle warfare, airborne rappelling out of Black Hawk, helicopters, parachuting. I got my first overseas trip of my life as a United Nations peacekeeper. You know, that was incredible. 6 months working and living in a third world country will really open up your eyes as to the realism of the world, you know, coming from first world countries where we have anything we want at the tip of our fingertips, to a country where they collect their drinking water from a tap in the middle of the main street, and they build their own homes out of thatches and huts. And I know you've seen it in India, like the poverty difference between first world and third world is so disparaging.
Yeah. I mean, our problems here in the U.S. is when the Wi-Fi isn't working. Yeah. Their problems over there is when they can't find clean water to drink and they're about to die.
Yeah. And their family's got dysentery and they've got no food. And
exactly. And they've got to walk 4 days to the nearest hospital.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the father's died. So the 12-year-old son is out there selling stuff on the street to make money to feed his family. You know, that's the reality of that sort of world. And so, you know, and I'm sure even you, I do, especially, I've got to pull myself back into check sometimes and go, hang on, whoa, give yourself a reality check and remember those times. And I saw it in Africa as well when I was out there filming anti-poaching. And it really just, it makes you appreciate, it gives you perspective. And I see nothing wrong with that. I think that all young people should have the opportunity to go and see what the world is really like. And so 4 years in, I was looking for what to do next. Am I going to, you know, you can stay in the companies and you can go for promotion, which really didn't, you know, entice me that much. I wasn't really interested. You can go to support company and become a sniper or mortars or heavy weapons or a signaler. And I tried that, went through sniper's course. Everyone on my course failed. I think they just weren't taking numbers. They just had to run a course. So then I tried signalers, passed that easy, but didn't get taken in. And then so last ditch effort, I got sent on promotions course and I hated it. It was just, it was like, as an infantry soldier, there was nothing there that interested me. And so I was reassessing, and we went on this course called Hewitt, which stands for Helicopter Underwater Escape Training, where you get into a mocked up helicopter suspended above a swimming pool, and they turn off all the lights in the building, and then they dunk it to the bottom of the swimming pool and flip it upside down, and you've got to escape. And so I loved that. It was awesome because I was a good swimmer, but not a lot of Army people are fantastic swimmers. You know, they'll pass their swim test, you know, but you flip them upside down in a steel drum in pitch black water. And yeah, so they had to have safety divers on site. And so I got to talking to one of them, and he was this thing called a clearance diver. And I'd heard about these guys and I didn't really know that much about them. I knew no one looked directly at them. They're kind of like the SAS and the commandos and the rangers and all that sort of stuff.
Or a director on a big movie set.
Yeah.
Do not speak to me. Look directly in my direction.
And so he was a really nice guy, and he told me a bunch of stuff, and I was like, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. And so, you know, it took a lot of work. It took a lot of time and patience, 12 months from the time that I put my paperwork into the time I could go on just the first phase of course, which was ships divers. and where you learned to scuba dive and search for bombs, which was a bit of a steep learning curve, seeing as I'd never dived in my life. You know, didn't even know if I'd like diving. I just knew I liked the water and the ocean.
Yeah.
But I took to it, you know, like without a problem, and loved it. And these guys are immensely fit, you know, so they pumped us in PT every single day. Before every single meal was 20 overgrasp chin-ups to a cadence. Whatever you didn't get out of the 20, you went to the back of the line and you doubled. Yeah. And so if you did 19, you did two. If you did 16, you did eight. If you did 10, you were there for the rest of your bloody life. And then, you know, every morning was 50 push-ups to a cadence. Every time you got an answer wrong in diving science or diving regulations or equipment, 50 push-ups. You know, I think we did 2,000 push-ups one day. Right? And it's just...
That's it?
Yeah. Yeah. But that was with the PT.
That's like a mid when I have to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. Yeah. I just drop 2,000 real quick, you know, before I jump back in bed.
Yeah, but you're clearly a weapon. a man beast, some would say. And so, yeah, that just took me to another level. You know, the Army taught me how to push past my boundaries. And the Navy taught me that there were no boundaries, you know, except for the ones that you put on yourself. And so, you know, we were doing underwater bomb disposal, land-based EOD, like in the Hurt Locker. We were doing underwater tools, so underwater welding, cutting, chainsaws, all that sort of stuff, long-range reconnaissance swimming, bombing raids, reconnaissance, like, you know, 3 hours in the middle of the night, pitch black water on 100% oxygen rebreathers so that we didn't have to, you know, we didn't get nitrogen narcosis where nitrogen absorbs into your blood system and then you have to do stops at certain depths for a certain amount of time to let the nitrogen out. On pure oxygen, you don't have to do that. So we could swim for 3 hours nonstop in the middle of the night to do, you know, bombing raids or sneak in behind enemy positions and things like that. And so it was a really interesting, multifaceted job and I loved it. And I passed all the courses, went out to the dive teams and I joined April 2005 and February 2009, we turned up, me and three of my workmates, to the big Navy base in Sydney to do some R&D testing of unmanned video and sonar equipment. This was all new equipment. They wanted to be able to put this stuff on the wharf anywhere around the world or put it on a ship. And they could turn it on and it would automatically detect if anyone was coming to put bombs on our ships. And so we were pretending to be the attack swimmers. And I had my new guy in the water for the first 30 minutes and then I pulled him out because I was in my wetsuit and I was getting warm. I wanted to do him a favor. And so I'd roll over the edge of the little black inflatable Zodiac we have, black wetsuit, black fins, and I'm on my back kicking my legs for about 4 minutes. And just out of nowhere, I just get smashed in the back of the leg. And I don't know what it is because it doesn't hurt. It feels like, you know, the guys in the boat had run into me. And so I look down and there's just this massive shark head. And I don't really know what to do because I've never seen a big dangerous shark. And it's taking a second for my brain to process this. And then my survival instincts kick in. I start fighting back and I go for the eyeball, but I can't. I don't know why. And I look down and I can see that not just my leg, but my hand is in the shark's mouth too. And I can see the teeth half embedded into my wrist. You know, I can't see it embedded into the skin of my leg because my wetsuit's there, but I can see it in my hand. Mm-hmm. And every time I try and pull my hand, I can see the flesh tearing. Mm-hmm. And so I grab it by the nose with my left hand. I try and lever it off, but that just pushes the teeth of the lower jaw deeper into the back of my leg. And so in a last ditch effort, I cock back to try and punch it in the nose. But that's when it decides I'm food and it starts to shake me. Mm-hmm. And the pain was just so immense. It took all of the fight out of me and I didn't actually connect the punch at all. It took me straight underwater and just started shaking me like a rag doll. And so there's just nothing you can do. This animal is, you know, 600 pounds of pure muscle in its element. And I'm just this weak, you know, sea monkey, as Andy Casagrande would say. And you just can't do anything. And the pain was so incredible. I just accepted I was going to die. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking, I'm not going home today. I'm going to die right now. And I asked myself in those moments if I was ready to die. And I thought back on my life, and this isn't like, time didn't slow down. Our bodies and our minds are so, they're such incredible machines, and all of this adrenaline and whatever other chemicals are coursing through my body and making me think at like, you know, lightning speed, and all of this is happening in a second. And I'm thinking, okay, am I ready to die? And I think back on my life to where it started out, to what I was doing now, and everything in between. And I thought, you know what? I've lived 10 lives in these 31 years. I've done more than I ever thought I could possibly achieve. If I'm going to die, I'm good to go. And so I just let go and I'm ready to die. And I feel like I'm about to drift away. And that's when the shark rips the last of my hamstring out of my leg and rips my hand off in the same bite. And because I'm not attached to it anymore, my wetsuit makes me buoyant. I pop to the surface and its tail thrashes water and splashes me in the face. And it shocks me back to reality. And I realize, gosh, geez, I'm not dead. And I see my safety boat. And I think I got to get out of here before it comes back. And so I start to swim and I take a stroke, but my right hand is gone.
So I'm sorry to stop you real quick. So let me get this straight. Your right hand is fully gone.
Fully gone.
Your left leg is fully gone yet?
No, just the hamstring is gone.
Okay, right, so your left leg is pretty much useless at this point.
I can't even feel it.
Yeah. Could you kick with it at all?
At that point, I didn't even know what was wrong with it.
Yeah.
I just couldn't feel it.
Yeah.
You know, so no kicking, no pain. I think the adrenaline's still coursing through my body. I can see when you see the surgery photos, there was a bit of my hand left hanging by the skin with like all the tendons and stuff hanging out, but it must've been hanging down my arm down the side there.
So at that point, it's just useless.
It's just gone.
It's gone.
And so
there's no way to reconnect it.
Not a chance. And so my instant reaction is see the wound. I've got to keep that above my heart to stem the bleeding, and not knowing that my leg is gushing blood and I'm swimming through a pool of my own blood. And so I'm swimming one hand and one leg back to the boat while the guys are coming towards me. And they, you know, I didn't think I was going to make it at all. I think I'm just waiting for this shark to come back and grab me by the ankle and drag me under. And it didn't happen. You know, the guys got to me first, pulled me out of the water, rendered first aid and kept me alive until the paramedics got there. But I was awake through pretty much all of it because I figured if I close my eyes, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
You know, if I look at my leg and it's horrific, I'm going to go into shock and I'm going to die. So I didn't look at my leg. I focused on tourniqueting my wrist with my left hand and looking at my buddy Tomo, listening to his voice and talking to him. And if I could see him, if I could hear him, if I was breathing, I'm still alive. And that's all that mattered. And so it was just kind of like that laser focus that the military trains you. Focus on one thing you can control at a time. And that got me through. The paramedics eventually came when the pain was just getting unbelievable and they pumped me full of drugs. I nearly died in the ambulance because the lack of blood, the boat was an inch deep in my blood at that point. There was an artery that was severed. My buddy had to pinch closed with his fingers.
Could you tourniquet your leg at all?
They did, but we didn't even have a first aid kit. They had to tourniquet with.
You're the military. How is this possible?
I know. They didn't even introduce tourniquets into the Navy clearance divers for 7 years later.
Wouldn't you have been like the case study to introduce a tourniquet?
You would think, but this is the military. Common sense prevailing.
No offense to any military people out there.
Yeah.
All right, stick around. We'll be right back. Okay, so we've all heard how great omega-3 fish oils are for human consumption, but did you know that fish oils are also beneficial to our dogs? Well, Lifeline Pet Nutrition has a wild Alaskan salmon oil available for our dogs that will provide the same supplemental support. This is nature's perfect source of DHA for brain, eye, and heart health. It will also produce a healthy coat, and this product will reduce excessive shedding by replenishing moisture to your animal's skin. Now, there's fish oils out there that have been bleached and overly processed, but wild Alaskan salmon is one of the few species of fish that remain relatively pure and natural. Believe me, your dog will be licking their bowl clean once they get a taste of this product. And who loves a discount? We all do. So be sure to check them out at lifelinepet.com. That's LIFELINEPET.com And for 20% off and free shipping on the entire cart, and who does not love a deal, enter Brandon on their website. They're a great product. I've had my dogs on this for a few months now, and I've seen a substantial difference.
Do you ever notice that your pet's fur may have lost its shine and not feel as soft as it should? Well, I've been using this elite conditioning shampoo made by Equus on my pack here at the ranch, and it's made a huge difference. The shine and softness of their coats is completely noticeable. You wouldn't put damaging skin products on your own body, so why would you do that with your pet? Equus products are made with the finest quality ingredients available, which are human grade and not industrial grade. That's very important. And they're also backed by a 100% money-back guarantee. And who wants a discount? I love saying that. Visit Equus.com. That's EQYSS.com. And enter Brandon at checkout for a 15% discount. That's Equus.com. EQYSS.com. Check them out right now.
First of all, what kind of shark was it?
When I saw it, I initially thought bull shark.
Okay.
Because we knew bull sharks were in Sydney Harbour. Generally, no other shark is going to go in there. And so that's my instant thought. The scientists confirmed that by looking at the bite marks in my leg and in my wetsuit. For the breadth of the bite, the shape of the bite, the distancing between the teeth marks. Mm-hmm. So they said it was a bull shark as well.
Okay.
About 9 foot.
Okay, so now for the audience that doesn't know, bull sharks, they're in the top three deadliest sharks in the world. How would you describe them as far as their temperament?
Honestly, it depends on where you're diving with them. I find them much more sketchy in places like the Bahamas. In Fiji, not as much because they've been habituated somewhat through the hand feeding of the dive groups there. They're much more polite in Fiji, but they, you know, the scientists say they have more testosterone than an adult bull elephant.
Is that true?
Well, that's what the scientists say. So you just got to work off the best science.
If the internet says it, it must be true.
Yeah, right. highly aggressive, very volatile. And I'm more inclined to keep my eye. Well, you know, you always keep your eye on every shark. But when the bull sharks turn up, you know, you question whether you need to be in the water. Because a tiger shark, big, usually quite polite, easy with the redirection. Great whites, very rarely are you out of the cage. And even if you are, they don't really come directly up to you. Bull sharks just can go from nothing to 100 miles an hour in a blink of an eye and will just bite you.
Yeah. Okay, so hold on. Because I want to get to the shark behavior and where you're, how you transitioned your life after the attack. So here you are, you're in the ambulance, you head to the hospital, obviously, most likely multiple surgeries, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Okay, so now your leg was still attached. When was the moment that they had to take it off? Was it right there?
No. I had my leg for a week. And they wanted to give it as much opportunity to see if it could be retained as possible. But day by day, I could see my foot going darker and darker and looking less lifelike because it wasn't getting the blood flow.
Is that gangrene?
Yeah, I guess. They had vibrating bandages around it to try and stimulate the blood flow, but it just wasn't doing anything. The bite was so immense. You know, it didn't just take my hamstring; it took part of my quad. It went from the base of my glute, my butt, all the way down to the back of my knee.
Yeah.
And so it was just too much missing. And after that first week, the doctor came in and he broke it down for me and he said, "Look, you can keep your leg." But we can cover it with a skin graft, but that chunk will always be missing. You'll walk with a limp for the rest of your life. You'll never run again. You'll carry it around like a lump of dead wood, and your happiness and your motivation and your fitness, all of that will suffer.
Yeah.
Alternatively, we can remove the leg and have you walking, possibly running on a prosthetic within 12 months.
So you had to do math in your head saying, okay, let's see here. What picks up more chicks? Big shark bite my leg, but I still have a leg.
Yeah.
Missing a leg. Now that right there is a puller and a deal sealer.
Yeah. That was the big thing, picking up chicks. Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. Course, I mean, obviously.
Not my career.
You did not think of anything else except what gets more chicks. All right. Got it.
Yeah. it didn't take me long to decide because I didn't want my happiness and motivation and stuff. I didn't want to carry this thing around with me and limp and all have people feeling sorry. I just wanted to get on with life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I had the leg removed. That was really, really hard because after the surgery, I went into 20 hours of agonizing pain where the pain management team couldn't get it under control.
Yeah.
And they took me out of I don't know why they did this, but previous to the surgery, I was in a private corner of the hospital. In recovery, they put me into the Navy. So this is like a normal hospital, but the Navy has half a floor.
Yeah.
Because the Navy hospital was being refurbished. So they put me into a room with six other people and I had the curtain around me. I'm on morphine. I'm tripping out on ketamine. I'm in absolute agony. There's a guy in the bed next to me. I can hear he's dying. Everyone's having visitors. And all I can do is lay in my bed, rolling from side to side, crying, wishing that I would die.
Yeah.
And I would not wish this feeling on another human soul, to think that your only option to stop the pain is to die. It got so bad, I begged my mum to go and find me a gun so I could kill myself. The lowest moment of my entire life. Unfortunately, they got it under control after 20 hours. And it was back to, okay, what am I going to do now?
So that's my next question. So here you are. You basically have a brand new chapter in life. Now you're missing most of your right leg. Your hand is gone. What was the transition that made you go from potentially could have been a guy that I'm just a shark attack victim, I hate sharks, I want them all dead, to now you are arguably one of the top people in the world that's you're one of the top conservationists, you're one of the most outspoken people to save the species. People see you on Shark Week 100 times, like I said, 100 times a year. You have become this shark conservationist and you're a fighter for them. What made you decide that, given the fact that you were nearly killed by one?
It didn't come instantly. But for one thing, I never blamed the shark. I was, as they say, I was in its home. It was just a shark doing sharky stuff. And I chose a dangerous life. I rode a big black Italian sports bike. I jumped out of aircraft. I played with bombs underwater. Like, how stupid can you get?
May as well start diving with sharks now.
Yeah, exactly right. And so,
there's only one way to go from there.
Yeah, yeah. And,
besides playing with tigers, I guess, or lions.
Yeah, or bears. Yeah, who's stupider, you or me?
I'm not one to talk.
Yeah, you're not missing any limbs, so I'm definitely stupider. I didn't blame the shark. I chose a dangerous life. And if you're going to choose to do dangerous things like skydiving or swimming in the ocean or whatever, every time someone goes out in the ocean, it's horrible. But that's the ocean. That's life. It can change on a dime. And if you choose to do dangerous things like I did, you can't get upset when things go wrong. Like, you might want to, but you can't justify it.
Yeah.
And so I didn't. I didn't give myself the ability to feel sorry for myself because that was my path. And so, it's easy to say, much harder to do. But it comes with practice. The more you, it's like riding a bike or learning to read and write. Like, how do you get better at it?
Yeah.
You practice, you train. And so I started training my mind because all I wanted to do at that point was go back to work. I just wanted to be a clearance diver again because, like we discussed earlier, I didn't have anything else. It's not like I'm going to be able to, play with bombs anymore. I look like I'm terrible at it. But what I could do in my mind was I could go to the dive school and I could teach these new recruits. And so that was the goal. And the chief of Navy was great. He said, as long as I wanted a job in the Navy, I'd have one. Mm-hmm. Don't think he realized I wanted my old job back. But that obviously was just a big impossible dream. And there's nothing wrong with having those, but you can't expect yourself to go from walking up a hill to walking up Mount Everest. You know, yeah. You've got to have training along the way. You've got to set small, achievable goals to fill yourself full of the belief that you can achieve bigger and bigger and bigger. And so that's really all I did. You know, 2 days after my leg was chopped off, I grabbed the handle above my bed with my one hand and I started doing pull-ups on that bar just so I could feel like I was achieving something. I could, from my bed, I could get my blood pumping, and my buddies brought in TheraBands. And we tied the elastics to the bars all around the bed, and I could grab them and I could work out from my bed. I couldn't even go to the toilet yet. You know, I was still peeing in a bedpan because I couldn't stand up, but I could work out because I had arms, I had a core. And so I just found ways. And over time, you know, I could get up, I could stand up, and I'd stand on my one leg in the window of the hospital, and my mate brought me a dumbbell in, and I'd train every single day, and I'd put on a sock and I'd hop around the ward, just getting my cardio in, and just kept constantly progressing. That was the thing that drove me the most, the constant progression. I learned patience and perseverance, because up until that point in the military, I could pretty much do anything anyone asked me to do. Paul, climb that mountain, swim across that ocean, shoot that gun, blow that stuff up. No worries, I can do it all. To a point where I was like, I can't do anything. I have to relearn how to write with my left hand. I've got to relearn to do my shoelaces up. I've got to relearn to do everything with my non-master hand. And so learning patience and perseverance became really important. You know, you can't be too hard on yourself, but you don't slack off either.
Yeah.
You know, you keep moving forward. And so I got out of hospital after 9 weeks, went home. One of my best mates quit his job up north in Queensland as a chef. The guy that I was working with before I left Canberra in the bars, he quit, moved in with me, and took care of all the things that I couldn't do. He cooked, he cleaned, he drove me to the gym every day on the army base. And I went into the gym and I relearned how to use my body again. And then piece by piece, I started getting prosthetics. I got a leg. That was the first thing. Hopping sucks.
I can imagine.
My balance is incredible. My left leg is super strong, but it still sucks. And so, after 3 months, 3 months to the day, I was living at Bondi Beach. I went down with my surfboard and two mates and tried to surf on one leg. And everyone's like, when was the first time you went back into the water? I'm like, there was nothing left to be afraid of. You know,
Did you look at it as a numbers thing? Like it's one in a million chance of getting attacked by a shark. I'm good.
Totally. And then if it happened again, geez.
Yeah, that's when I'd stay out of the water. Yeah. If it happened a second time, I ain't going ever back in.
Yeah, I got fish blood or something. I think that when you come that close to death, you either curl up in a ball and you're afraid of everything.
Yeah.
Or you can go the other route and realize there's just nothing left to be afraid of. Because trust me when I say this, when you come as close to death as I have in the most horrifying and violent and painful of ways, you realize that death isn't anything to be afraid of.
Yeah.
You know, not living your life and going to your deathbed with regrets, that is way more scary.
Yeah.
Because that's all you have in those last minutes. I wish I'd done that. I wish I'd said sorry. I wish I'd been more adventurous. I wish I'd lived instead of going, I'm good. Let's go.
Yeah.
What's the next adventure? You know, so that is way more terrifying to me than sharks or dying or anything. And so there wasn't anything left to be afraid of. And so I'm free. Like I literally feel free of clinging to a mortal coil, and I have the opportunity to do anything I want. You know, I was scared. I really wanted to go and learn to parachute, but I was worried, not that I couldn't do it, but that I'd get turned down and they wouldn't let me do it. And then, you know, a show popped up 2 years ago for Shark Week. They paid for me to go parachuting, and now I'm throwing myself out of a plane with a big steel hook on my arm and a robot leg. And I get to use that to inspire other people that they can do all the things maybe they thought they couldn't do as well. And so that gives me a huge sense of fulfillment. And so I ended up going back to work after 6 months.
So now so that was your recovery, but what was the moment that you decided to transition from Navy clearance diver to shark diver slash shark expert slash shark conservationist. I mean, you became the face of sharks. Well, you became the motivational speaker for the guy that was attacked by a shark, and you jumped back on the horse.
Yeah. Look, it happened because my shark attack was such huge news around the world, but especially in Australia, because yeah. I was the first clearance diver ever to be attacked. The first person in Sydney Harbour to get attacked in 60 years. And so every time there was another shark interaction around the country, the news would come to me for an opinion and a comment.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want to look like a dumbass on television. And so I had to learn about sharks. Mm-hmm. And through doing that, you know, knowledge dispels fear.
Yeah. You
know? And so the more I learned about the plight of sharks, the more I realized how much they have to fear of us than we do of them. You know, you take the 7 people around the whole planet that die from sharks every year
yeah.
to the over 100 million that humans kill. You know, who should be scared of who? Yeah, and so
a lot of people don't know that, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. Well, no, your average person out there, they hear about the shark attack stories. So the media is going to say, oh my God, somebody was killed by a great white shark. It's a big news story, but it's not a big news story when the 100 million sharks a year are killed for their fins. Uh-huh. So yeah.
just recently in the last week or 2 weeks, they coming out of South America, they caught a boat with 26 tons of shark fins.
Yeah. You know, now, why do they want their fins? What is it about the fin that makes these fishermen, or I call them poachers at this point?
Yeah.
What is it about the fins that they want?
They want status through the ability to provide shark fin soup at their restaurants, weddings, celebrations, all through, you know, mostly China. But also widely through Asia themselves. Mm-hmm. It's for the shark fin soup.
What is it about the shark fin that's
nothing?
Is it just the taste?
It's like a lot of this stuff, like rhino horn and all that good stuff. They say that it has medicinal properties, and I guess one of the old beliefs was that sharks don't get cancer, and so they think if they eat shark cartilage, then they won't get cancer either. But it's not mainly about that. It's more about the status, because it's an expensive, exclusive type thing, like puffer fish, you know. And so they all want to have it at their celebrations. It literally does nothing.
Yeah.
It's cartilage. Yeah. It has no medicinal properties whatsoever. The soup is actually flavorless.
Yeah.
And so these hundreds of millions of sharks are being killed for nothing because people want to have an ego. And that's the most despicable thing about it from my perspective. And so that was when I felt like I had a voice. People listen to this voice. I can't waste it. I need to stand up for these people. And there was a transfer from my desire to serve in the military, to stand up for people that can't defend themselves and speak up for them, to doing the exact same thing for our oceans and for our sharks, because they can't do it either.
Yeah.
And I just don't see the difference anymore of, you know, someone goes into a field and there's a cow there, and they just smash a big fat steel hook through the cow's face and drag it around the field for an hour. How is that different to what we do to sharks? You know, I don't like beach fishermen and commercial fishing, and a lot of these sharks are caught as bycatch as well. So the fishermen just throw out their nets, throw out their long lines, and catch whatever comes in. And they might be going for tuna. They might get 1 ton of tuna and then 30 tons of everything else.
Yeah.
And then they'll just throw everything else back in the ocean.
Dolphins, whales, shark, you name it.
Everything, rays. Yeah. Like, everything. And they just throw it back in. It's called bycatch, or they call it waste.
And throw it back in dead, correct?
Yeah, throw it back in dead.
Yeah.
You know, and then so that they can fill up their tanks with the fish that they want to catch.
Yeah.
And so commercial fishing and the fishing industry and people eating seafood is the number one contributor to the deaths of our ocean and the deaths of sharks. I couldn't do it. I couldn't be a part of it anymore. I got that deep into it. I was just like, I can't consume anything out of the ocean anymore. And I just stopped. But then, you know, I started public speaking, which was the only thing I was more afraid of than sharks.
You know? It is terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I started doing that, and you know, that just opened up a whole new world, a whole new career for me. And so that led me to Discovery Channel.
Yeah.
you know, they asked me for an interview. And I guess I was so used to the camera and speaking by that point that I did well. They liked it. They flew me out to LA to be a part of Shark After Dark.
Yep.
And then they liked that so much, they gave me a co-hosting job the next year with Andy. And that was when I saw my first great white shark with Andy. I did my first cage dive with Andy. I did my first full show with Andy. And it was just all of these firsts. And so I have such a love for him and the way that he looked after me and taught me. And, you know, it was such a great experience. I just didn't want to give it up.
Yeah.
And so now I'm continuing down that path.
So that's that's the obvious question. So here you are, you've recovered from your injury. Now you're missing a leg, you're missing an arm. This all happened by a shark. What was your first experience like actually diving with sharks for the first time, seeing these animals, whether it was the type of shark or any shark, seeing the animal that took your leg and yeah. your hand.
I'm not going
to
lie.
This animal changed your life.
I'm not going to lie. It was a little freaky.
Yeah.
It was actually for 60 minutes. They wanted to reintroduce me to sharks. And so they took me to the Ocean Life Aquarium in Sydney, in Manly. And they have a tank with grey nurse sharks, which some people call them raggies or sand tigers. They're very like very chill, like puppy yeah. dogs, but they have teeth that hang right out of their face. And
yeah.
they used to get accused of all the shark attacks because of how scary they looked. But they're like they're the most docile freaking sharks there is. And so even though I knew that in my head, I was much more comfortable looking at the tail. And so that's like when I looked at the teeth, my imagination got the better of me and I would see it turning its face and ripping my face off. And so yeah. I just looked at the tail. You know, I haven't always been a tough guy. and so I looked at the stingrays and the turtles and the shark's tails, and it was
denial peace. Is the best way to yeah, deal with
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Just don't
just
look.
Just denial. It's like there's needles. No shark there.
Just don't look.
Yeah.
And so yeah, it was piecemeal. It was slow. You know, then the year after that, there was a big auction that I was a part of, and so one of the prizes was two tickets to go diving with the sharks at the same place. You know, I organized that prize for people, yeah. and the guy said he would double the amount he paid if I went along and did it with him.
Yeah.
And so it was for charity. I'm okay, fine. And so I went along, did it again, and then 60 Minutes wanted to do a follow up and not only take me diving with sharks, but they wanted me to dive with the sharks that actually changed my life.
Yeah.
And so they took me to Fiji to dive with 30 big bull sharks, and not just bull sharks, but six other species of sharks. There's so many sharks in there, you can barely see the water.
Was this like a Fear Factor part two or something like that?
Because no, dude, it was just, honestly, it was a free-
Were they just trying to freak you out?
It was a free trip to Fiji.
Well, that's why. Yeah. So then you just drop out right there and yeah. be like, I'll just be on the beach all day.
Exactly.
Well, dude, I'll go back on Sunday.
Look at my career path. You know, I don't really think about too much things before I sign up for them.
Yeah.
I usually just jump in head first. So it was more like, sweet, I'm going to get a free trip to Fiji, going to go diving. I just didn't worry about the sharks until I got there. And, you know, we did 2 days of diving, four dives. And on the very last dive of the very last day, everyone had left except for the main guy that owned the shark diving company, who yeah. was a South African clearance diver, and the cameraman. And I looked at him and I looked at the cameraman and no one else was around. And I reached into the bucket, grabbed a fish head and fed a bull shark.
Yeah.
And then we went to the surface. Yeah. And so that kind of
did that put you at peace?
It put me at peace.
Yeah. yeah.
It
yeah.
taught me that they're not mindless, lurking, predatory, killing machines waiting to snatch your children. Yeah. They're just sharks doing shark stuff.
That was my next question. What's the biggest misconception with sharks?
Yeah, one thing is that they can smell a drop of human blood in 10,000 leagues of ocean. We busted that myth. I jumped off the back of the boat in the Bahamas surrounded by lemon sharks, bull sharks, hammerhead sharks, and tiger sharks with a bag of my own blood that we'd just drained on the boat. And I swam away from the boat in just a pair of shorts, a pair of fins, a mask, and snorkel, and I tore open the bag of blood. And it just engulfed me.
Yeah.
And the sharks didn't do a single thing. Then
were you just trying to get them to bite you?
No, not at all.
Like, what if something happened?
I had faith.
That
in
would have
my
been
skills.
Marked down in a Darwin Award.
Yeah, seriously. Look, honestly, I had faith in my skills. I had faith in the skills that everyone has taught me over the years.
The Matrix?
In how to handle sharks, how to redirect, and you know, after I did that, they threw a bucket of fish blood in the water, and I swam through that. That was a very different story.
I think I recall watching an episode of Jackass and seeing Steve-O yeah. do this.
Uh-huh. He tied like tuna steaks to his crotch and swam with sharks. Yeah. Maniac.
So in reality, just for everyone listening, because most people don't live near an ocean, they have this idea that if you go into an ocean and there's a shark nearby, you will get attacked. I mean, that's not the case, is it?
If we knew how much sharks were around us when we were in the ocean, we would never go in there.
Well, I don't think you're helping the audience right now.
But that's the thing. So few people are getting attacked and bitten and eaten, and like no one's getting eaten.
Yeah.
Like, really.
So your chances are one in a million, basically.
You have more chance of dying in the car on the way to the beach.
Yeah.
By a factor of 100.
Especially when I'm driving.
Especially when you're driving.
I mean, I drive like a maniac.
So it's like you said, it's a numbers game.
Yeah.
Any number of things can kill you from day to day. You can slip in the bathroom. You can, I don't know, fall off something. There is so many more things to worry about than sharks.
Yeah.
I swim in the ocean all the time. You know, haven't been attacked by a shark again yet.
I think you're good. In fact, I'm going to go surf with you. I'll be like, well, he's exactly, safe. You know, exactly. I'll just stay right by you.
Yeah. It's like going into the ocean is one of the most incredible feelings in the world.
Yeah.
You know, being totally encompassed in nature, it washes away your worries. It makes you feel free. Never deny yourself that feeling. It's incredible.
Yeah. Okay, so you have a Shark Week coming out this year.
Well, I do 3 episodes a year. I've done one already. I believe it's called White Heat. It's looking at the genetic differences of the 2 separate populations of great white sharks in Australia.
Yeah.
And we also tested out a new wetsuit that is ingrained with a material that stops the teeth actually getting all the way through.
Is it like a chainmail?
No, not at all. It's like a flat polypropylene.
Really?
So is it
would this work with a white?
Yeah, that's what we tested it with.
Really?
Yeah.
A big one?
Yeah. So
it sounds like it would implode your body, but not get the teeth.
Well, you know, the pressure maybe, but sharks don't always go to bite you at that full pressure. You know, usually, especially with humans, they come up and they take a bite, but it's not like they're hitting a seal. They're more curious and they'll come and take an investigatory bite.
Yeah, yeah.
And so these were hitting it hard. And so it's got a layer of neoprene, a layer of polypropylene. And so we use that in the Navy for berthing ships, and it's got a 40,000-pound breaking strain.
Really?
And so they lay it flat between 2 layers of neoprene, and the shark's teeth can get through, but it doesn't get through enough. And we know that most shark deaths don't come from like being eaten, it's from traumatic blood loss.
Yeah.
Because the teeth get all the way through, hit our arteries, and then we die. So this is actually going to stop traumatic blood loss.
Really? Okay. Yeah. And so what's your third one?
Well, I've got 2 more. That's just the one.
Oh, sorry.
I got 2 more that we haven't shot yet. You know, COVID's kind of taken over the world.
Oh, so, good old COVID.
Yeah. Hopefully, as soon as this thing wraps up, we're going to be shooting again straight away.
And you got a book coming out.
I got a couple of books coming out.
Oh, look at you.
Yeah, I know.
God.
So I
feel like a total loser now, by the way.
No, well, one of them is just a very small book. One of them is an e-book I'm releasing. Should be out by the time this show's out. People always ask me about how to get into the military and military training and how to train fitness-wise. And so I just did a short book, e-book about what turned me from a pack-a-day smoker and alcohol abuser into an elite military athlete. And like the stories through it, some training things that people can test out. And so that's the first one coming out. And I'm having a lot of problems getting my I have a current book, No Time for Fear, but it's only published by Penguin in Australia. And I'm having trouble getting it into America in commercial quantities. So I'm redoing the whole book. With a new guy, my buddy Geraint, who is Iraq, Afghanistan veteran from the UK. He's a 3-times New York Times bestseller ghostwriter for James Patterson. Mm-hmm. He's done his own book about Afghanistan, 3 historical fiction books about the Romans fighting the Gauls. So he's got such a great repertoire. He's helping me write it because I have the stories, but you know, I'm not a writer. He's going to help me put it into a format where it's more enticing than just me saying, yeah, and then we drank some beers. You know? And so that's coming out probably just before Shark Week launches, probably around mid-June. We haven't decided on the title yet, but it's expanding on the old book because the old book finished around 2012.
And well, you do have an old book, and talk about that one too.
Well, that's what the old book is, No Time for Fear, but we're redoing that, and then we're going to add to it with all the Shark Week stuff, all the cool stories about working on documentary film crews and catching crocodiles and skydiving into the ocean for 44 hours and all that cool stuff. So
yeah,
I'm looking forward to that one coming out because it's going to be much more updated.
Yeah. Well, dude, I'm so glad you stopped by, man. This is awesome.
Of course.
I actually learned more about you today than everything. And I still confirm the fact that I'm more charming, but you're better looking, man.
Yeah, I have a better accent.
All right, that wraps it up for today, folks. If you haven't done so already, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. It always helps us. And also, if you haven't picked up a copy of my book, here's my shameless plug, Lucky Dog Lessons, Train Your Dog in 7 Days, anywhere where books are sold. And also, you can follow me on Instagram at Animal Brandon, Facebook at Animal Brandon, and Twitter at Brandon McMillan. And what is your social medias?
I just keep it simple. Paul D. Gelder.
Paul D. Gelder. And then just Instagram, no Facebook?
Instagram, Facebook. Twitter. I'm more prevalent on Instagram. I enjoy it a bit better over there.
Follow this dude. I mean, most of it's just like working out and, you know, doing pull-ups off elephant tusks and stuff like that.
Haven't done that one yet.
All right. All right. Have a good week, everybody.